This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Tech Talk and my name is Jeff Sandhu. Last week, we said a sad farewell to the humble video cassette, as he's never one to let a theme run away until every last useful drop has been bled from it. Today, we're talking to Culture Pop's Matt Armitage about the technologies that are past their prime but refuse to die. And we have to talk about, you know, computers, Matt.
Okay, yeah. Hi, Jeff. Last time we did a show like this, which I think was about 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of people globally were still using Windows 98, which, of course, you know, is a platform that predates even the explosion of the internet. So I'm happy to report that that statistic is now close to zero, but a worryingly high number of desktop users are still using Windows XP, again, an operating system that first came out in 2001 and was last updated 8 years ago. Now, that percentage at 6.5%, it might not sound like much, but when you compare it with Apple only has a 9.5% share of the desktop market in total. So when you see these kind of legacy systems, that's still a really huge number. And despite the free upgrades that Microsoft has been offering to its latest system, Windows 10, it still lags hugely in share to Windows 7. So 7 is no longer being given what Microsoft calls mainstream support. So I guess it's only being, you know, security patched and not much else. But it's weird to think that over 40% of desktop users are using an operating system that was released in 2009. But I guess that's the point. You know, we become so attached to the familiar technology that we don't want to part with it. We don't want to change anything. And of course, you know, a lot of business users don't want to pay for new stuff when their staff is, you know, perfectly able to produce the third-rate work that keeps the company consistently sub-profitable in the first place.
Now, are these the oldest operating system that's still in use?
I think we might have mentioned this item on Geeks a few weeks ago. The U.S. might have, you know, drones that can be controlled from Texas and flown over Afghanistan, but not all of their computer systems are quite so up to date. So the system that controls their responsive last resort, their nuclear defense system, actually runs on an IBM Series 1 computer from the 1970s. That's 40 years old, controlling the world's biggest nuclear arsenal. And it still uses giant 8-inch floppy disks. And these things contain, despite the fact they're huge, they contain so little data that you would need 20 of these just to store the data from a photo taken on your smartphone. And one of the reasons that this hasn't been replaced is very simple. It still works. And the theory is, you know, why fix it if it isn't broken? But the Pentagon has committed to upgrading the system by 2020 because, again, it's very hard to get things like 8-inch floppies and the drives that they work on. And, of course, they're not the only ones in the U.S. government system either. Apparently, the Treasury Department in the U.S., which is what controls all the money, is actually based on an operating system from the 1980s. But on the plus side, I guess it's hard to hack a system when there's hardly anyone left alive who still knows how to actually operate that code.
Now, the replacement curve seems so much faster now, though.
It does seem weird that we look at technologies or devices that are less than 10 years old and we think of them as being, you know, obsolete. Operating systems are a really good example. We've become used to these annual upgrade cycles. And the same with our devices. You know, you look at something like the original iPhone from, I don't know how many years ago it was now, like 7 or 8, not a huge number. But you look at that as being big and heavy and having a tiny screen. And we forget that most of the world is still using things like, you know, the trusty old Nokias with a basic camera. We are really spoiled. First of all, you know, we can afford to buy these mini computers. And second, we have the ability to charge them whenever we need to. Across much of Africa, for example, mobile phone use is, you know, the penetration is getting really high, but they're often reconditioned phones, or they're locally produced, or they're quite basic. And they have, you know, you can make calls, texts, maybe have a quick game of snakes, but they're not really feature-rich. They're not really delivering that kind of 4K experience. They're 4G experience. They're very much kind of 2G phones. And in many cases, the reasons are simple. They're cheap, they're robust, they've got really good reception, and most importantly, the batteries last for days or possibly even weeks. In places with irregular or limited access to electricity, the last thing you want is a phone that, you know, conks out about 6 o'clock in the evening, whether you've actually used it or not that day. And even when we come back to the developed world, things like broadband aren't as widespread as we like to think. In the U.S., as of last year, there were still over 2 million people using America Online dial-up. That is a 56K connection speed.
Wow.
In the days of broadband. Yeah, amazing.
Now, terrible internet connections aside, which we in Malaysia are very familiar with, what are some of the perfect technologies that we haven't replaced over the years?
Well, again, a lot of the things we've used for so long, we don't even think of as being technology. When we learned to control fire, that was one of the first big steps in our evolution. Then making tools, spears, arrows, weapons, all the things that allowed us to hunt. Then came domesticating crops and animals and building houses. I mean, a lot of us live in, you know, quite fancy houses or apartments now, but a lot of the basic technologies there, the roof, the foundations, the walls, those things are very old. We keep tweaking, but the basic underpinning is still the same. Or look at something as simple as a knife, a fork, a spoon, or a set of chopsticks. People keep trying to palm us off with sporks and all these kind of, you know, weird cutlery things. But these originals are actually very elegant technologies that work so well, we really don't need to replace them.
Mm. Are there any other personal technologies on the endangered list?
Well, handwriting. How many of us actually write with a pen every day? Not many. So, you know, so much of what we do now is on computer and just on computer, but there's still a very good reason to teach people how to write on paper. If you aren't near an electrical device, if there isn't any power and you need to leave a message for someone, or you need to, you know, put some information down, then pen and paper is the way to go. So even though a lot of countries are moving towards educating kids on computers, there's a lot of care being taken to preserve handwriting, even if, you know, there isn't as much focus on making the handwriting nice as there was when I was at school. And, you know, we use emojis, and they're great to send on a phone, but it's going to be a really slow process if we revert to, you know, sending people hieroglyphic pictures instead of the written word.
I know you want to talk about music formats.
Yeah, of course. The last time we did a show like this, I think we talked about the so-called vinyl renaissance. You know, millions of vinyl records are now being sold every year. And at first it was, you know, a very hipster thing, but now it's a genuine movement. People who want physical formats, they want the cover artwork, you know, they want that tangible thing to hold in their hand. I still think it's a bit of a daft hobby in a country as hot as Malaysia. You know, there's no new technology that stops records from melting or warping, but I am glad it's getting bigger as a global trend. But of course, the hipsters have moved on, and they have moved on to cassette tapes. And again, there may be a few of our listeners who don't know what a cassette tape is. You might have to Google that. And I didn't realize, but there is actually still a company here in Malaysia that manufactures and presses cassettes. There's an article on the Juice magazine website from earlier this year, if anyone's interested in checking that one out. But a lot of bands, or a lot of kind of hipstery bands, have started issuing their music on tapes. It's, you know, part of this underground thing. You're saying to your audience, you know, if you want to listen to our music, here's the barrier that you have to cross.
But don't they sound terrible, though?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's definitely a loss of sound quality with tape compared to CDs or to vinyl records. But most of us listen to music now on low-quality streams or rubbish MP3s, and we listen to them on headphones through a phone with terrible sound processing. So they don't actually sound any worse than the stuff we're already listening to. I mean, the sound quality of what we're listening to now compared to 10 years ago is a lot worse in general. So I think cassettes in that sense are actually quite cool. And I have to say, cassette was my favorite format when I was growing up. And it's not just something with the hipsters. I found out as well that in many states in the United States, in the U.S., the prison service bans CDs because they can be crushed and used as weapons. A few states allow MP3 downloads, but they tend to be censored. So, you know, hip-hop tracks will have all the curse words bleeped out, and a lot of material's not available. So a lot of prisoners still use tapes for their music because the prisons don't censor that content. And that means there's still a large market for blank audio tapes in the U.S. The biggest problem, though, is not getting the tapes. It's actually the players themselves. So prisoners have to hang on to and trade these, you know, Sony Walkman that were made 20 years ago, not to mention figuring out how to repair them inside a prison when the parts wear out.
And what are we ending with today?
Well, I'm still baffled why dot matrix printers exist, and not just exist. Makers like Epson keep releasing new ones, and they're not cheap either. But I think I've probably spent enough of my life talking about dot matrix printers, so I'm not going to think about them anymore today. Instead, I'm going to leave by leading you all into the light. In parts of the world, especially in the European Union, the good old-fashioned incandescent bulb, which was invented in the 19th century and popularized by Thomas Edison, is actually being phased out. And there are very good reasons for doing this. You know, they're very fragile, they're very energy inefficient, and of course, they don't last very long. I mean, we've all had that thing with our light bulbs where you flick the switch and they go ping, and then every other light bulb in the house quickly starts to go ping as well. LED bulbs, on the other hand, are, you know, pretty energy efficient. They can last for years. But as we know, LEDs emit blue light, which can mess with our circadian rhythms. I recently replaced most of the LED bulbs in my house with old-fashioned incandescents. Is it environmentally friendly? No. Is it better for me, my wife, and my cat? Very definitely. I mean, I can't give you any scientific evidence to uphold my claims, but, you know, I certainly feel better and I experience less eye strain when we're using the incandescent bulbs. And in a sense, it's a shame because, you know, I'd like to see this technology being phased out for environmental reasons, but the point of technology is to have something better. And until we do, then, you know, the old tech is still the best tech.
Matt Armitage there from Culture Pop talking about old technologies that refuses to die. When we come back in just a moment, we will do Geek Squawks, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.